Well, thanks everybody for coming this afternoon. My name is Toby Dalton. I'm the Deputy Director of the Nuclear Policy Program here at Carnegie, and it's great to see such a large turnout. I was thinking that perhaps we had mistakenly advertised an open bar or something like that as part of this, but it doesn't seem common to get so many people out on a Thursday afternoon in July, but we're really pleased. It's great to have two of my colleagues here, Laura Salmon and Ashley Tellis, to talk about issues related to Indian and Chinese nuclear perceptions and dynamics and so forth. Laura, many of you may not know, and if you don't know her, it's only because she's been spending so much time in Beijing for the last several years. She's an associate with the nuclear policy program there, did her PhD in Chinese at Tsinghua University, and is quite an impressive Chinese speaker. Before that, she was a visiting fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in New Delhi, and so is quite familiar with a lot of the Indian and Chinese nuclear issues. And over time, she's developed some really deep connections in the nuclear establishments in both countries. Ashley Tellis probably needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him nonetheless. He's quite well known in Washington as a senior associate here at the endowment, working largely on South Asia issues, has held a number of positions with the US government over time, including in the last administration as a senior advisor at the US Embassy in New Delhi and as part of the NSC staff, before which he was a longtime analyst at the RAND Foundation, RAND Corporation, excuse me. I think it's become quite clear, and it's clear with having so many of you here today, that there's an increasing understanding here of the importance of the Sino-Indian relationship. And although we'll focus, I think, more on the nuclear dynamics today, it's clear that that is a very broad and complicated relationship. And implicit, I think, and maybe Ashley will talk about this a little bit, in the U.S. thinking about the strategic relationship with India is a recognition that that dynamic is something we need to better understand and calibrate against over time. Now, Laura has just held in Beijing a conference that she'll talk about more with a number of experts and retired officials from both India and China, in which, for the first time, actually, we got to observe some of the conversation between the two on the nuclear issues. And hopefully she'll have some interesting things to say about that. And with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, Toby. It's a great honor to be here and be back in Washington working with both Toby and Ashley on a number of issues. As just mentioned, we did just have an event actually at the beginning of June, June 2nd and 3rd, and we invited 40 participants in total. And actually, I think we ended up with about 60 in the room from both India and China, that were members of the military, academic, and also scientific establishment in both countries, some retired, some still current, and also senior and junior experts. I'd like to make that emphasis as well. So we had the next generation of people who will be working on these issues also in the room, which is important to emphasize. So today I'll be talking about some of my takeaways from this particular event and what the implications are, hopefully, for the U.S. That will be Ashley's role today. And because it was a Chatham House rule event, I won't be ascribing particular statements to particular people, but we will be issuing a volume which you can look up people's individual viewpoints in that. Just to give you a bit of history, over the past decade, I've been attending a lot of conferences that have to do with Sino-Indian relations, and one of my takeaways from all of these conferences is that often there's this impulse to leave aside challenges, just concentrate on what you can do now in the economic realm to move things ahead, which is all well and good. However, I find that in leaving aside a lot of these challenges, there isn't a lot of substance at a lot of these meetings. There's a discussion of Chindia, Chindustan, and these bigger, vague concepts without a great deal of detail. And after a decade of attending conferences on China and India, or China and U.S. Strategic relations from the nuclear side, I also have found that there's an overall lack of forums to discuss China's nuclear relationship with other countries, particularly its neighbors. So that was the goal of this particular event. And I think it was also done in the light of my own research, in which I found most of the comparisons between the two countries have been at the economic level, often ignoring an area that I think actually there are a number of similarities between the two countries, and that would be actually in terms of nuclear posture and then also in terms of nuclear practice, and I'll be getting to that today. So from this event, one of my biggest takeaways is I found in terms of posture, and posture can be defined in a number of ways, but in terms of nuclear attitudes in terms of doctrine and how the two countries are looking at their nuclear arsenals, there are a number of similarities. And I came up with 7 similarities, and it's just in terms of posture, 3 similarities in terms of practice. In terms of posture, the one that stands out the most, and I'll be spending the most time on today, is no first use. Both countries, of course, ascribe to no first use, they with an emphasis, of course, on survivability, credibility, and second strike, basically is a retaliation or retaliatory capability, as weapons of last resort. It's a defensive capability. And China's position was made clear throughout this entire event that it maintains a level of unconditional no first use. Unconditional was mentioned numerous of times. However, there are nuances that came up during this event. In terms of China's no first use, one of the major generals in the room, who's from the Chinese side, said that China does maintain no first use when it comes to India, but will retaliate if attacked. Now, what constitutes attack and what constitutes retaliation, of course, was not specified. But that was kind of the baseline that we went with at the beginning of the event. Where all the qualifications came from were actually from the Indian experts in the room when it came to China's no first use policy. There are numerous questions on the credibility of China's no first use policy. One expert in particular noted the targeting of Indian cities. He used he set the number at 60 cities had been targeted by Chinese warheads. Now, obviously, the Chinese in the room all took issue with this, but this was one of the things that was mentioned. Also, there were numerous questions raised by the Indian side and had to do with nuclear modernization and also changes in operational doctrine. For example, so why would China, if it maintains a level of no first use, need such a great level of nuclear modernization in order to promote its arsenal? There were also suggestions that China may be altering its no first use stance. And many of these, that when you probe to see where they were getting this information from, there were a lot of references to media articles, particularly from the West. So what was the big takeaway in terms of what the Indian side was talking about in terms of China's no first use? They used the word conditional. So they see it as a conditional doctrine or traditional practice or conditional, while on the Chinese side, obviously, they see it as unconditional. How is it conditional? The first area, of course, has to do with the border, with Arunachal Pradesh and Aksai Chin. This idea that if in the case of a conflict scenario, because China has not relinquished its claims in these two areas in particular, that it would not necessarily not use a nuclear weapon or at least use it for coercive purposes, threaten to use a nuclear weapon. Also, if an adversary were to conduct a conventional attack on China's strategic missiles or infrastructure, the argument from the Indian side is that China could retaliate with nuclear weapons. Also, even if it's not a direct retaliation, there was an argument that there are efforts on the part of China to circumvent no first use through its nuclear assistance to Pakistan, using it as a proxy. Finally, in terms of China's technologies and that are being developed to defeat U.S. missile defense, these were also brought up as potentially useful in terms of China exerting some form of nuclear threat against India. Multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles as part of the nuclear modernization, maneuverable warheads, all of these things came up as undermining strategic stability. And I'd like to point out they were using strategic stability in the Indian-China context. Now, from the Indian side, what was noteworthy on the no first use principle is that there was still an emphasis that it is a clear policy within India. However, it's changing. And these comments in particular that I'm going to focus on just now came from an academic who was in the room. And I want to emphasize that point. This is not retired military, so you always have to take this with a grain of salt. He was arguing that philosophy of no first use in India has evolved. He pointed to the fact that the nuclear doctrine remains a draft. And were India to be attacked by biochemical weapons, that there would be, quote unquote, a reason to activate the nuclear arsenal. Once again, an academic, so that is, I think with a lot of these things, we're being refuted left and right by the Chinese. In terms of voices to depart from no first use, there was an argument by a senior ranking former admiral who was also in the room who suggested that there has been discussion within India that due to China's assistance to Pakistan, this idea of a two-front war, two-front theater that you hear over time, that there have been discussions about India leaving behind its no first use policy. It's also predicated upon Pakistan's increased production of fissile material, tactical nuclear weapons that we often hear about, and terrorism. And always in the background, interestingly, I saw this reference or heard this reference to China's assistance or China's help. It's not always direct assistance, but China's shadow is generally in the background there. The second area beyond no first use is minimum credible deterrence. So minimum deterrent for both countries. I found that in the discussions that there was general agreement that it's not really about numbers, it's more about survivability and being able to conduct a retaliation. However, there are once again nuances in the Chinese and the Indian stance on this. From the Chinese experts who were in the room, there was still, you still see a reference, in fact, even in the writings, to limited credible deterrence. They use the term yōxiān in some of the writings, instead of using zuìdì, which would be minimal, which I thought was interesting. And I think that it doesn't necessarily point to a change in doctrine, but I think that there is sometimes a rhetorical laziness that needs to be probed a little bit further. There needs to be more precision and a probing as to what they mean by these terms. Chinese, who are also experts within the room, one of them in particular, also argued that deterrence is not central to China's strategy. In this case, I'll also highlight the fact that he's an academic as well. He was arguing that no first use and nuclear taboo are actually much more important than deterrence for the Chinese. Deterrence in their concept is tantamount to coercion. And he has a good deal of interaction with the PLA and was saying that for the PLA, it is basically coercion when you use that term. What was particularly striking for me, though, from the Indian side in the response to what they were hearing from the Chinese, is that when they talked about minimum deterrence, they argued that it wasn't universal in the Chinese case. That the Chinese actually, within the second artillery, have a two-level doctrine, meaning the credible minimum deterrence is reserved for the United States and Russia, but limited deterrence within a theater context is reserved for India. And I thought that was a particularly important point and takeaway. So you see already this idea of a conditional no first use. You see a non-universality of minimum deterrence coming from the Indian experts who are in the room. Now, in terms of the Indian experts, when they were talking about their own country and their own form of deterrence, I heard a word quite frequently, and I just heard it this past week at an event Toby spoke at, this idea of dynamic. It's a dynamic doctrine. It's a dynamic theory. And you see this within India's strategic doctrine, the draft that's out there. India's deterrent size, components, are all dependent upon its strategic environment, technological imperatives, needs of national security, so it's evolving over time. So what was really striking to me is while you see the Indian experts criticizing China for nuclear modernization, non-universality of its deterrence posture, and also conditionality of its no first use, India also finds the situation to be dynamic and changing, and changes are occurring. The third point, the third area of confluence is disarmament. Both sides do hold or support global verifiable non-discriminatory disarmament. Once again, there are nuances. From the Chinese side, or when we're talking about China, Indian experts were questioning, once again, the sincerity of China's link between nuclear and conventional disarmament. They felt that in too many forums that the two had been drawn together, and they saw that as being disingenuous. Also, this prerequisite of having regional or even global peace in order to achieve disarmament. On the Indian side, the centrality of nuclear weapons, I think, really came through, not just for the Indians, but also for the Pakistanis. So in this environment in which both sides are also increasing their fissile material stockpiles, it's also, I did sense a certain degree of pessimism and skepticism, I'd say, when it came to the idea of disarmament, despite the fact that both countries do support it. Fourth, negative security assurances. That's another area that both are in agreement once again on. The difference, once again, Chinese, within their statements, refer to an unconditional negative security assurances for non-nuclear weapon states and also nuclear weapon-free zones. While on the Indian side, you don't see that that word, unconditional. Also, there is a degree of conditionality assigned to the fact that those that are not aligned with nuclear weapons powers would be eligible for negative security assurances, while others would not. There's a qualification there. Both altogether on nuclear weapon-free zones express mutual support for the Bangkok Treaty from Southeast Asia. In terms of demating and launch on warning, have not obviously taken on mating or launch on warning within their own stockpiles, although this could change with nuclear submarine developments and submarine launched ballistic missiles. And strategic restraint was emphasized again and again by both sides. Both were arguing against the potential for expanding their arsenals and also for an arms race. So That's all in doctrine, in terms of their posture. In terms of practice, obviously there are also a number of areas in which there's confluence between the two countries. Missile modernization, and there were frequent references actually by Indian experts in the room to missiles that don't necessarily have an implication for India. The DF-21, DF-31, also submarine launched ballistic missiles. On the Chinese side, there was frequent reference to the Agni-3 being deployed and operationalized, and this movement towards fourth and a fifth solid-fueled MIRV systems and also submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Ballistic missile defense, that's another area in which you see both moving ahead. And on this point, I'll say that actually the Indians that were in the room and then also within their writings afterwards emphasized the fact that they did not see India's ballistic missile defense program targeting China. They saw it as specifically focused on Pakistan. That being said, however, they also emphasized that in the future, the goal is, of course, to have 5,000 kilometer intercepts and to expand this into a multi-tiered system. They have the two-tiered system now. They want to move ahead. And so there are implications for China in the future. And finally, the one last area that I'll say that there was a good deal of crossover is in the civil nuclear energy field. If there's any one area that had the most positive, generated the most positive feelings and agreement, I would say it was civil nuclear energy. In terms of nuclear energy ambitions, scale, fast breeder reactor programs, reprocessing, regulatory issues, and all these things that have come up post-Fukushima, everyone in the room was in agreement that there needed to be more coordination between them. And so in understanding these similarities and these nuances that I brought up, I really was pushing in this event for people to come up with ways that we could cooperate or the two sides could cooperate. The first one that came out and was the most obvious had to do with agreements and bilateral statements. No first use, non or de-targeting, depending on if you see targeting already existing. There were arguments that there should be joint statements. There needs to be a bilateral agreement between the two. Negative security assurances, no attacks on nuclear installations. These were all suggestions. Communication channels. There was a sense that the strategic dialogue mechanism is broken or actually just doesn't exist between the two. And one of the Chinese experts in the room suggested that there needs to be a differentiation between what is a real threat and what is a false threat. Because I think from the Chinese viewpoint, a lot of these things that were being said were false and had come from media, from, for example, Huanqiu Shibao, which is a Global Times, and is quite frequently used in India and is not always the most reliable source. Overall, there's an idea of trying to differentiate between capabilities and intent, and that's what I heard coming from the Indian experts quite frequently. Now, how to get to this point of communication, definitions and terms. There was also general agreement that there needs to be something akin to what has already been developed between IAPCM, which is the Institute of Applied Physics and Computational Mathematics in Beijing, and the Center for International Security and Cooperation, CSAC, in the United States. There's a glossary, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, of Chinese and U.S. nuclear terminology. And that glossary actually has been very useful to facilitating discussions. And there was a lot of support in the room to have something similar between India and China. And they're actually already working on one between India and Pakistan, to my knowledge. For a lot of these terms, for example, today, minimum credible deterrence, limited deterrence, no first use, both share these basic concepts, but their views on them are actually quite different. Also, during the event, we had a number of terms come up, like nuclear self-defense, nuclear strategic guidelines, strategic sufficiency, nuclear weapons-enabled terrorism. We can discuss these during the Q&A as to what each of those mean, but they need to be defined and they need to be explored. Specific CBMs, just briefly, there was a recommendation that neither deploy ballistic missile defense or ballistic missiles within a 1,000-kilometer range from the line of actual control. There were suggestions that there needs to be more cooperation on things like nuclear terrorism or counter-nuclear terrorism, illicit trafficking, in terms of detection. Nuclear weapons safety, that was raised by one very senior Chinese major general who I think actually would have a fair amount of influence in actually coordinating on this, not just in the Sino-Indian context, but also Sino-Pakistan. And finally, nuclear energy. In 2006, Hu Jintao, obviously, and Manmohan Singh signed a civil nuclear cooperation MOU, and yet nothing has really come from that. And I think there are a lot of areas that actually could be built upon that already exist. So finally, I think in terms of joint studies is another area that really stood out to me as a point of cooperation in the future. We talk about low numbers, certainly in Washington, disarmament, these ideas of getting down to low numbers. And China, India, and also China and India, Pakistan are three countries that actually have low numbers already. In terms of crisis and arms race stability, I think there need to be more studies of these microcosms, more of the role of conventional weapons and nuclear reductions in a low numbers environment. And I think it's also wrong on the Chinese part to a degree, and I think this was found out through the event, to assume that China's only nuclear relationship is actually vis-a-vis the United States. Actually, there are a number of its neighbors that it needs to consider these relationships with, and that really came forward during the event. And there was a lot of momentum, I think, for holding these events in the future. Finally, post-Fukushima reevaluation and coordination. Once again, earthquake damage and siting, regulatory systems and reforms, safety and security at these nuclear facilities. Those were all mentioned as areas for future cooperation. So how to get to that cooperation? One point that was made by an Indian expert in the room is that you need to create space for cooperation. One of the biggest hindrances, of course, as we all know, is that India, standing outside of the NPT regime or the nuclear regime or nuclear non-proliferation regime, has been isolated for a long time, and that China has been unwilling, at least at the track one level, to engage them. This was brought up by both Chinese and Indian participants in the room. But they felt that at the track two level, at least we could make some movement forward and in fact be a little more frank about some of their real opinions about Pakistan, about some of their real opinions about the United States. Also, when you lack that direct contact between this bilateral contact, when you break apart those triangles that everyone talks about and you just deal with two people on the arms, you know, or two states on the arms, it also avoids this whole issue of going through a third party, the prism of a third party to understand the other. And we see this all the time. So while this is a bilateral event, I want to emphasize before concluding that we did not ignore external forces. The United States, Pakistan, media were ever present in these discussions. And one of the words that I heard the most frequently during this entire event was the word surprise. The Chinese participants in particular were extremely surprised by the level to which India or Indian experts are looking to China as a nuclear issue. Because they've, for most part, have only looked at the United States as a nuclear issue for decades now. In fact, all the terminology, every speech that came out from the Chinese side actually made a comparison between the Chinese nuclear relationship with the United States and the Chinese nuclear relationship with India. They needed that toehold in order to be able to analyze it. So I think that's extremely important, and we can't avoid talking about those linkages. The one linkage that I think is missing, however, right now is the China-India link, and that's what we're hoping to fill through these kinds of events in the future. So finally, I just wanted to conclude by saying that one of the things that stood out to me is the lack of proper signaling between the two parties, between Chinese and Indian side. If one actor finds everything to contain a signal, and in this case it's India, and the other side misses all of the signals altogether, you have a tremendous asymmetry. And in this case, China's the one always missing the signals. I think it's also dangerous for China to have a nuclear posture that's really essentially based on calculations vis-a-vis one country, the United States. Yes, they factor in Russia occasionally, but really it's all about the United States. And they're dismissive of their nuclear neighbors. And I think that in order for them to actually have a safe security environment, that has to change. So for future events, the idea with this one large event that we did is to break up the panels into specific targeted seminars. And then also to try to mess, or what should I say, to alter these configurations so that we allow other participants to come, whether it be from Pakistan or Russia. Because I think it depends on who you have in the room, what kind of discussion you're able to have. And as I mentioned before, we'll be publishing an overview, a volume of all of the papers and discussions. So if you're interested, I would encourage you all to check the Carnegie webpage and see what comes out from our developments. And it hopefully will serve as a baseline for understanding Sino-Indian nuclear dynamics. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Laura, Ashley, you want to jump in here?
Sure. Thank you, Toby. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Laura, for asking me to comment on the presentation you made this afternoon. I want to start by actually congratulating you for taking the initiative in doing this, because the Sino-Indian nuclear relationship in particular is extremely complex and is completely understudied. it's something that is hard to discern from the perspective of each side because it's so opaque. And the number of players who actually have authoritative understanding of their own country's nuclear postures and doctrines is actually very small. So the idea that you can bring together a group of people who can have a reasonably honest conversation actually is a giant step forward. And so I hope you sustain this. If nothing else, there'll be many eager flies on the wall waiting to see how this conversation transpires. What I want to do today is to kind of pull back and not talk so much about the specifics because I wasn't there. I look forward to seeing the draft document that comes out and try and situate what we know about the Sino-Indian relationship and how it's going. Am I doing something? Sorry. And how it plays itself out.
Maybe.
One of you guys
has
a BlackBerry that's too close to the
player. I don't think I do. Maybe I do.
It woke everybody up.
Let me switch this off before it's gone. Oh, sorry, hang on.
Let this be a lesson to all of you.
Apologize for this. I rarely carry this except when I travel by train, so this is one of those days. Anyway, I have little difficulty accepting that the broad thesis that was clarified in the discussions, that the Sino-Indian nuclear postures are congruent, is basically right. I have no difficulty with that. Because as Laura pointed out, across a variety of facets, there is, in fact, quite some degree of similarity in the way both sides think about their nuclear positions. A few caveats, however, are in order. The first is not much is really known about how congruent these positions are, particularly in their detail. And as you correctly pointed out, at the 50,000 feet level, the idea that both sides have a no-first-use doctrine, that both sides see a certain value in having a demated posture, all this is right. But when one drills down into the details, I suspect there will be enough nuances that require further scrutiny. So that's the first point I would make. The second point is that we need to be careful about reifying what is a current reality with a permanent reality. Both in China and in India, the nuclear positions and the nuclear capabilities on both sides are in quite a remarkable transformation. And it's not clear at this point whether the end results of this transformation will reflect what we have taken for granted in the past. And so again, this is an opportunity for a sustained conversation and a greater attention to detail. And the third point, again, that I would flag is the choices made by both sides are shaped very much not simply by their bilateral calculations, but by calculations involving third parties. And for India, of course, it is Pakistan, very much so. For China, it's the United States, first and foremost, as you pointed out. So I think we need to keep those points in mind when we address the congruence thesis. But apart from the issues of congruence, the broad point I would make is that there is reason to watch the Sino-Indian nuclear interaction closely in the years to come. Because this nuclear interaction is embedded in a bilateral relationship that is fraught with a considerable degree of suspicion. I don't think it's a relationship that is defined by outright hostility or by a pure zero-sum game mentality. I don't think it's that. But even though there are elements of cooperation, sometimes strong, sometimes tacit, these elements of cooperation sometimes get overwhelmed by what is a large degree of suspicion about the motives of the other vis-a-vis each of the players involved. And I would argue that the future suggests that this suspicion will only grow deeper. And it'll grow deeper not simply because there are outstanding bilateral issues like the border which will continue to persist for some time. I don't think there is an imminent solution to the border dispute. Certainly, I don't expect to see one in my lifetime. So if there are any optimists, I would love to have a conversation with them. But apart from the border issue, what you have are two powers that are rising in terms of capabilities, which have a very clear sense of their own aspirations and their own destinies, and unfortunately happen to be located on each other's doorsteps. And that's usually not a condition that makes for very amicable relations at the best of times. And given the history of this relationship, you've already had one major war. You've already had a strong set of fears, nurtured in both capitals about strategies of encirclement and counter-encirclement, which each side suspects the other is involved in. And the prospect that there are very important third parties like the United States, which have a vested interest, in a sense, in one particular bilateral configuration in this relationship rather than some others, all makes it a very complex story that will affect the way their nuclear forces involved. So what can one say about broadly their nuclear interactions? I would argue that to understand Sino-Indian nuclear interactions, you want to think of them at three levels. The first level is the public interactions that take place at the level of diplomacy and in very visible sorts of ways. The second level are the hidden strategic decisions that each side makes vis-a-vis the other without necessarily announcing what those strategic decisions are. And to the degree that we even know about these strategic decisions, it's only because these pieces of information are either leaked or because there are third parties who have access to this information and it somehow becomes public. And then there is the third level, which involves choices involving third parties. And I think to understand the nature of the Sino-Indian nuclear relationship, you want to think about the interactions at all three levels. Let me say a word about each of these. At the broadly public level, what you see is a very interesting asymmetry. And that asymmetry, essentially, at the Chinese end, is centered on the proposition that India is not a nuclear threat to China. India, in fact, is not even of any consequence to China, as far as China's security calculations are concerned. And for all practical purposes, India may well not exist, except when it makes a nuisance of itself, from Beijing's point of view. So there's almost a sense of distance, if not disdain, that Chinese scholars and Chinese policymakers have expressed when they've thought of India as a security challenge. Of course, when you flip the mirror and kind of look at the perceptions in Delhi, you get exactly the opposite perspective, where because of the asymmetries in size and capability, and the fact that, of course, India went to war with China in 1962 and came out at the unfortunate end of the stick in that interaction, you get the view in Delhi that China looms large out there as a very serious security challenge to India, not just now, but will increasingly remain so in the future. So you get a sense in Delhi where China is seen primarily as a challenge and an objective constraint on India's aspirations, and therefore drives a set of fears in India which are going to lead to strategic choices with respect to its own nuclear program. And the fact that many Chinese scholars in your conversation have identified things like the Agni 2, Agni 3, and whatever comes after the Agni 3 as being ingredients that China ought to kind of take into account is not surprising, because when you look at these capabilities, these are designed primarily to target China. And from an Indian point of view, are absolutely essential because they see that as somehow equalizing the strategic balance between the two countries. So when you look at the broad public level, you get, in some sense, neglect in Beijing, bordering on disdain about India as a strategic challenge. And in New Delhi, you get a view of China that is very much front and center in the strategic calculation, almost sometimes bordering on an obsession. And so I think that is something that one needs to take into account, not because it's simply a perception, but because the perception actually has certain consequences where it comes to procurement, decisions that are made with respect to deployment, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's the second level, and the second level is the hidden strategic choices that each side has made vis-a-vis the other. Now, by the very fact that these choices are oftentimes hidden, we don't quite know what they are. But based on what one can glean from the public record, I think it's safe to say something like the following. That ever since the mid-1970s, when India tested its nuclear device, China, without making too much of a fuss about it, has treated India as a nuclear adversary that has to be deterred essentially by some allocation of its own nuclear capabilities. And thanks to the work of James Malvenin, among others, we have now been able to at least identify certain Chinese missile bases that have had responsibilities for targeting India as part of larger targeting responsibilities in South and Southeast Asia. What does this tell me? What this tells me is that no matter what position China takes publicly about India being a strategic challenge, China has done what it believes is the minimal prudential things necessary to protect itself against what might be Indian depredations in the future. And to my mind, it's done it in a rather clever and interesting way. That even as it has done the necessary precautionary things it needs to do to protect itself against India, it has not gone to town advertising these choices, nor has it supplemented its nuclear deterrence decisions by raising the temperature with respect to conventional security competition. In fact, people are often surprised when I tell them that if you look at the conventional military balance between China and India today, it's actually India that has conventional military superiority along the contested border. And that is partly because of historical decisions made in the 60s and the 70s. It's partly because of the terrain. And it's partly because India did not make its own strategic nuclear decisions until very recently. And therefore, the strongest kind of arrow it had in the quiver was its own conventional forces. Now, when you look at the Indian decision, when you look at the Indian end of the second level, what you see is a twofold kind of approach. The Indians have invested greatly in preventing what they fear could be a replay of 1962, and that accounts for the strong conventional investments that they have made since 1961. And after 1998, they have now reached the conclusion that the conventional superiority, while important, is not sufficient, and therefore has to be supplemented by increasingly nuclear deterrence. And after 98, for the first time, we have begun to see strategic decisions made in India, which involve the creation of nuclear delivery systems that are aimed quite simply and plainly at China. And this is primarily the long-range missile systems. Then, of course, you have the third level. And the third level is the choices that each side has made, taking into account third parties. For India, the strongest matter involving third parties has been, one, the United States, and the second, Pakistan. That is, the Indians, even though they've always had a self-regarding view about non-alignment and their desire for strategic autonomy, have always recognized that America's strategic capabilities actually provide India a measure of protection because of the externalities that come from any nuclear deterrence relationship. That is, to the degree that the United States has the capabilities to deter other nuclear rivals like Russia and China, India benefits from that protection. In fact, for 30 years, those positive externalities of American deterrence were strong enough to prevent the Indians from having to make their own nuclear choices, because they figured that as long as China was not a substantial great power, which was true at least until the 90s, and the United States still kind of ruled the roost with a massive set of nuclear capabilities, India did not have to buy its own forms of nuclear insurance. Now, obviously, after 1990, this view that U.S. deterrence could provide sufficient externalities to prevent India from developing its own deterrent, obviously this view began to erode, and that's why India decided that it had to supplement its capabilities with its own nuclear programs, which are programs that are now underway. The second, of course, is Pakistan. And this is where the Chinese view of the relationship with third parties intersects uncomfortably with the Indian view about third parties. That China, for its own reasons, decided to support the creation of a Pakistani nuclear program, partly as a form of assisting Pakistani security, but equally partly as a form of boxing India and keeping it confined to the subcontinent. I mean, it's a classic decision of realpolitik, and it's probably a decision that any one of us would have made if we had the right to make that decision in Beijing. Given the nature of India-Pakistani interactions, it was far too tempting for China not to make this decision, because what it provides in effect is essentially balancing on the cheap. And therefore, it's not surprising that whatever the immediate precipitance that led up to the Chinese decision to support Pakistan and its nuclear program were, the end result of those choices were that Pakistan ended up essentially containing India in substantial ways. And the fact that now the Pakistani nuclear program is actually quite a formidable program in its own right, only from Beijing's point of view, should authenticate the wisdom of that original decision, because it genuinely now confronts New Delhi with a two-front problem in the nuclear realm of very serious magnitude. From the Indian point of view, of course, the Pakistani nuclear program, which at least arose in the initial phases with a great deal of Chinese support, is seen first as the classic piece of evidence for China's malafide intentions towards India. And you can hear this whenever you meet Indians who talk about this program. But more importantly, what it has done is that it has nullified what India viewed as its strongest suit vis-a-vis Pakistan, and that is its conventional superiority. And so in one fell swoop, from New Delhi's point of view, the Chinese assistance to Pakistan ended up denaturing India's biggest strategic asset, which was its size and its superior conventional capabilities, in a sense almost reducing India, bringing it down a notch or two. Now, given the fact that these are the three levels at which the two nations operate, it seems to me that when one looks out to the future, one is likely to see a nuclear modernization that is going to remain a work in progress for quite some time to come. The Sino-Indian nuclear relationship, for all practical purposes, will remain asymmetrical. That is, Chinese nuclear superiority will remain unchallenged by India, no matter what India does, for at least the next decade or the next two decades. And unless India goes back to renewed nuclear testing, I just do not see how India would be able to balance that nuclear relationship with China. Now, thankfully for all of us, I think Indian objectives today are relatively modest. They aim at replacing what is currently and has been for about 30 years a relationship of abject vulnerability vis-a-vis China with a relationship of asymmetric vulnerability. That is, even though China will be able to unleash massive damage on India should there be nuclear use because of the kinds of weapons that China has. What India appears to be seeking, at least in the near term, is simply the ability to mount a riposte, which even if it doesn't equalize the damage, will give China some reason for a strategic pause. So I think that is going to remain pretty much the kind of outcome that one can imagine over a period of time. By itself, this actually will provide a certain degree of stability because it's not going to be mutual assured destruction, but it's going to be horrendous destruction by any absolute measure. So as long as both sides continue to persist with their current modernization programs, I do not necessarily think that the sky will fall. But I would flag two or three areas of uncertainty that I think are worth watching. First, is either side capable of shifting from what is currently a city-busting nuclear capability and move towards something that resembles a counterforce capability? This is not technically impossible, and it can actually be achieved without renewed nuclear testing. If either or both sides move in this direction, I think the relationship between the two at the nuclear level will become a lot more complicated. The second is that both sides today rely greatly on opacity in order to enhance survivability. Nobody knows where the weapons of these two countries are. As best one can tell, neither side seems to know with certainty where the weapons of the other side are. But survivability that relies on opacity is subject to opacity coming apart if technology matures rapidly enough. And so if there are breakthroughs, particularly in a world of Google Maps and whatever else exists out there that can enforce transparency, if this opacity is peeled away, what is the impact for strategic stability? So this is, again, something that I would pay attention to. And the third, of course, is the complications that come simply from new technologies, whether they be things like MIRVs, whether they be things like ballistic missile defense or what have you. What do these new technologies imply, again, for strategic stability? These are three big baskets that I think we need to pay attention to. What does all this mean to the United States? I'm going to end in a few minutes just saying a few words on this. First, what I think it means is that the Sino-Indian nuclear relationship will continue to remain one of two very active nuclear rivalries in Asia for a long time to come. There will be an India-Pakistan interaction, and there will be a Sino-Indian interaction. And as far as I can tell, these will be the two active relationships that will remain until such time we can bring this to an end either by a fissile material cutoff treaty or by a CTBT or some other diplomatic instrument. So this is something that the US certainly needs to pay attention to. The second point I would make is that although all the three parties in this relationship today swear by minimum deterrence, I am a deep skeptic about this because the concept is so utterly elastic that it allows for a range of capabilities, all of which can be subsumed under the label minimum. And so I think one needs to kind of look beyond simply the label to details that currently are not carefully discussed. And those details involve numbers. Those details involve things like delivery system accuracy, involves things like yields, and it involves all the other things like protecting these assets, making certain that there's strong negative control, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line for me is that as long as there is an elasticity to the problems of minimum deterrence, all the old fears that we saw during the Cold War about first strike stability will never quite go away. Now, this doesn't mean that they will mimic what we saw during the Cold War, because thankfully the bilateral relations between India and Pakistan and India and China are relatively moderated. I mean, this is not high-octane geopolitical competition. But should their political relations move in that direction, then the nuclear relationship will also become susceptible to changes that could be quite significant. The third point I would keep in mind is that the nuclear relationships within Southern Asia will begin to be affected seriously by developments that occur quite outside this part of the world. And the first most important relationship, of course, is what happens in Northeast Asia. The future of the North Korean nuclear program, the future of what happens in Southwest Asia, the Iranian nuclear program. And then over the longer term, the future of latent nuclear powers like Japan and what they choose to do in terms of their own nuclear capabilities, depending in part on the future of U.S. extended deterrence. The last point I would make is that all this, when one looks at it synoptically, suggests that there is a great deal of uncertainty about how this is going to play out. And what that tells me is that, one, the notion that we are going to move in a hurry towards a world where nuclear disarmament becomes a practical reality is likely to be chimerical. I don't think that is anywhere on the horizon. And no matter how much we may wish it, in this case, the wish is not going to produce the reality we want. Which then has, of course, one important consequence for the United States. And this is a controversial proposition, but I'll put it on the table nonetheless, because at least I believe it, is that if nothing else, it makes the case for the U.S. maintaining a very robust set of nuclear capabilities. To my mind, that becomes a very profound outcome that comes out of all of these dynamics. That while the U.S. should certainly move to reduce its arsenal consistent with the requirements of stability and safety and to the degree that we can get rid of unwanted peripheral tools that we have accumulated over the years, we should certainly do so. But I would feel uncomfortable if this disarmament on the part of the United States reached the point where we are unable to shape the outcomes that would occur in this part of the world. So I'll just end on that note.
Thank you. Well, Ashley, we can always count on nothing if not controversy from you. So there's lots of fertile ground here. I thought I might start with a first question for Laura. You talked a little bit about language and the importance of terminology. And you also mentioned that a number of times strategic stability was something that was talked about at length. And I wondered if, in your view, both sides have a same or at least similar understanding of what strategic stability means in that region.
It's an excellent question. I think in terms of, I'd say across the boards, one of the things I was pointing to is while there are seven aspects of posture or dynamics that they are in agreement on, no first use and all these various things, and as rightly pointed out by Ashley, that there are very different concepts in each of these areas, and there are a lot of nuances that have to be pointed out. Those caveats, in a lot of ways, are just as important, if not more important, than the term itself. In terms of strategic stability, My general sense when people were talking about it, if you're going to compare arms race stability with crisis stability, is they're talking about it as crisis stability. The problem is that a lot of times, once again, I think it could be said on all of our parts, a certain degree of rhetorical laziness. People will talk about it as a form of stability without really using it in the nuclear context, and it's automatically ascribed a certain role. But I think in most cases they were talking about crisis stability as the future, as the what the two sides need to work on in moving ahead. The only issue being there was a large debate about transparency and just how transparent both sides were willing to be. And this comes back to this issue of numbers. It certainly in the U.S.-China relationship, numbers have been a sticking point for forever. And I see in the Indian-China context, obviously, no one would want to move ahead on that point. In fact, the idea of opacity is heavily guarded in order to foster the whole idea of no first use, minimum deterrence, and everything else.
Jonathan.
Yes, I'm Jonathan Pollack from Brookings. I'd like to see if I could get both of our very able presenters to descend from the rarefied heights of global strategy and all this fine calibration and do something much more basic. And that is to examine the behavior and the programs of both states at much more, dare I say, a bureaucratic level. It's clear that there's a to a degree, if in different ways, a symbiotic relationship here between India and China. But I'd be very interested in hearing from both of you on where either one of you would place the priority that and the power that attaches to nuclear weapons programs relative to other military goals. Both countries have very, very ambitious modernization programs. I'm much more familiar with the Chinese program, but what strikes me is that China's nuclear modernization has been a very, very deliberate long-term policy. They deploy less than one might conceptualize them capable of doing. And if we are to look at China's military development, I dare say the resources that are being put into conventional programs and maybe into other areas may have priority over a nuclear program. So what does that do to calculations we might make on the urgency or the presumptive centrality of a nuclear dynamic here relative to other goals? And I would pose that to both of you. Do we know anything that would enable us to clarify this apart from all the refined calculations that we've heard about? Thank you.
Would you want to go first?
Sure. It's a very good question, Jonathan. I think what you described as characterizing the Chinese effort actually is a very good descriptor for the Indian effort as well. That is, both sides, in my judgment, and Laura may have a different view, I'd love to hear what she says, but both sides, in my judgment, have defined for themselves some desideratum of what they think is necessary in the nuclear realm in order to service their national interests. And those national interests span, of course, the United States and then a whole series of secondary nuclear powers. But nuclear weapons simply do not have the centrality for either China or India that they had for the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. I think that's a very important point to keep in mind. Now, the reason we are focused on nuclear issues today is because, one, it's the subject of the conversation. But you know, that accident aside, we don't want to draw the conclusion that somehow both states are going gangbusters in a nuclear expansion because this is somehow the metric by which they are either going to measure their own great power capabilities or because they think of these as being the instruments through which they will realize certain political objectives. I think that's a very important point. Both sides, I believe, have a numerical target that they are working towards in terms of developing capabilities without either announcing what that target is or necessarily freezing that target in perpetuity. So in that sense, there's a certain flexibility. But it's not a unthought through or necessarily open-ended program. They have a certain conception of what deters, and that is linked very much to what their calculations regarding the survivability of their own forces are relative to the targets that they want to hold at risk. And subject to that complex calculation, they're going to build up capabilities in diversified form. But when you match this relative to what, to my mind, is the real pointy end of the stick, which is conventional forces, the resources applied to nuclear weapons will still be very, very small. That is certainly the case in India. If you look at the amount of resources applied to the missile programs and the nuclear weapons program, relative to what it costs to maintain the conventional Indian military, it's a fraction. And I would wager, I haven't looked at these recently, but I would wager that you'd get a comparable result for China as well. Now, what is interesting, I think, is that if you believe that the sword point is going to be conventional forces, and the standing balance today were to change as a result of these investments, the impact of what that change would mean for their nuclear strategy is something that I think is very interesting and worth investigating. I don't think it's an exercise that has been either completed or even begun. But if one were to posit that over a period of time, what we have taken to be the standing conventional balance were to change dramatically, what impact would this have on the way they think about nuclear weapons? I think this would be an interesting question for us to think about. But your bottom line intuition is exactly right, and I would say that that holds across the board for both countries.
And just as my own brief response, because that was very eloquent, it's always hard to follow Ashley and have something new to say, but I would say I agree. I think that in terms of what I was emphasizing today was this idea of strategic restraint that comes up again and again and is mentioned during this event and you see across the boards. And I think that that is definitely there. One of the things that was striking to me was that there was such an effort to bend over backwards to say that they are not engaging in an arms race. There's no interest in expanding arsenals and to engage in what occurred during the Cold War. That's first and foremost. I hate to completely, though, disconnect conventional and strategic military. I think that, you know, they go hand in hand, and so I hate to completely isolate one from the other. And I think that within their own context, within their own strategic doctrine, it's still part and parcel. They're part of the same coin. In terms of the question on conventional weapons, I think that was part of the reason I was talking about these two countries. I think would be an excellent case study, also the Indo-Pakistani case for low numbers. When we talk about the role of conventional weapons, when you're dealing with countries that maintain a very small arsenal compared with other ones, because I think that is a point that we can study in the future, and that's what I'm hoping to do within this project. Thank you,
Jonathan. If I can just add one more point, because I think something that Laura said is important. There are a range of conventional capabilities, which, I mean, strictly speaking, are conventional, but in practice serve as supporting capabilities for nuclear operations. And this is primarily in the area of command and control, communications, war planning, etc., etc. So we may have a methodological problem on the margins, because even conventional modernization will have some benefits for the nuclear. But I think on the broad issue, we are in agreement with what you said.
Could I just, one other point, though, is that in the Chinese case, nuclear weapons were originally given an enormous priority within their military programs for a long, long time. But now what you're describing is nukes as, if you will, subordinate to conventional. And it would be very interesting to know, at least in the Chinese case, how that happened. It's a worthy mm-hmm. undertaking.
If there are any aspiring doctoral students out there, there you go.
So, take it on.
Go ahead.
Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire. This is for Laura. You spoke earlier about signaling and how China was not aware oftentimes of the signals India was perceiving that I was giving. Could you discuss a little bit more how that signaling has possibly stirred the pot, when maybe that didn't need to happen, and also what role the media has played, the international media, the Indian media, in furthering this signaling?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's an excellent question, and I'm surprised always in our events how often we come back to the media. In fact, we just had an event on media recently in the Sino-Indian relationship, because it is so central to how the two are communicating. When we talk about third parties, I think actually in a lot of ways, even more than the United States and Pakistan, the media could be said to play a great role. Overall, in terms of signaling, I think the issue that I run into the most is this asymmetry in terms of the level to which Chinese experts are looking at India. Yes, they're looking at India, but a lot of the reporting that you see within China that has to do with India tends to be very culturally oriented. Food and travel and things like that in a lot of the documents. Or it goes to the other end of the spectrum on the blogs, and then it becomes extremely, sometimes heavy-handed and a little bit extreme. And those obviously are the pieces that then are picked up within the Indian media and then spun ad nauseum, because they, first of all, sell well, and they feed into this larger obsession, I think was mentioned before by Ashley, with China as a form of justification exactly for why they should be concerned about China, right? And it also lends itself well to what we were talking about before in conventional military terms and also strategic. If you want to increase your investments, all you have to do is pick up one of these articles that says that China wants to break India into pieces And all of a sudden, you will have your backup for why you are arguing for why you need new airlift capabilities at the border. So I think that it goes hand in hand, and I think the problem is that media has played a negative role in a lot of ways, and mainly just because there's a lot of selective translating going on, I would say, of these Chinese articles. I think also the signaling in general, as I mentioned during the talk, is there was a genuine level of surprise in the room that the Chinese just hadn't, for the most part, been exposed before to these issues. Now, that actually points to a different asymmetry that I mentioned, where they're so focused on the United States that it's almost impossible to even think of anyone else in the nuclear context, and India included. Now, the U.S.-India civil nuclear deal changed that to a degree. It reset the focus so that the Chinese are looking a little bit more at India than they used to in the past, but it's still through the lens of the United States. And so I think the part of the missignaling is this, because it's not direct. It's bouncing off of all of these different players, and one of them being media.
You mentioned that there were a number of younger analysts that were included in this conference. Was there any different sort of sense or perception about media and signaling among the younger crowd than the older crowd?
I think the younger crowd in general, in part because they probably read a number of these blogs as well, their viewpoints, and I don't know that this is necessarily a good trend, is that they can be influenced by some of the more extreme views and tend to have a little bit more of a hardened viewpoint on some of these issues than they might otherwise. I think the people who've been in the field a little bit longer tended to take everything with a grain of salt and not necessarily invest a lot of credence in what they were reading online. But I think that for younger generations, I think they're very susceptible to being influenced by these media outlets.
Marco?
Hi, I'm a former diplomat who served both in China and India. There was an anecdote that was often told in New Delhi. Basically, the challenge of dealing with Indians is that Aristotle never made it through the Khyber Pass. And at the same time, Aristotle probably made some limited inroads in China through the Jesuit missionaries there in the 17th century. You, Laura, keep talking about the fact that there are all these differences in language and these differences on how problems are perceived. To what degree do you think that India and China will be able to bridge these cultural differences, or find a way to find common ground to even to begin to discuss these problems that are really, from the point of view of U.S.-Russian attitudes, are really very firmly based on a very strict logic and procedure?
I would say that it's an excellent question. I think, you know, language can always play a role, and I don't mean to overemphasize it. I think that one of the things that's striking to me is that you have so many areas of doctrine and practice in which there are similarities already existing. And I tried to point to those seven areas in posture, and also three areas even in current modernization programs that already exist. So there's actually a firm foundation, actually, for better cooperation already there, at least to parse out a few of these nuances. And I would argue that in the U.S.-China case, where you have, you know, years and years where they've been talking past one another and finally, you know, were able to create a dictionary, this glossary that they're able to communicate with each other on, has been invaluable. It was just the process of creating a glossary was invaluable to getting scientists, to getting people within the structure to talk to one another. And I think that something similar could be extremely useful for China and India. I think all of the roots are there already, and actually, If you look at it on the table, actually, there's a lot more similarities there than less of a gap than you have between the United States and China when they're talking about strategic stability. So why not actually facilitate this one-on-one direct interaction? I think in the future it makes sense to have other players coming in and talking as well. But I think right now where I see the weakest link is on that point. And I think that actually if they were to emulate a few of the mechanisms that the United States and China had used to get themselves to their current level, For all intents and purposes, is however you look at that, it would be a good endeavor. And you can actually have things like a strategic economic dialogue on the Indian-China side as well.
So there's two questions together back there. Let's just take both of them.
Thomas Doggett, Northern Virginia Community College. Laura, when you're talking about the Chinese policy stance, I mean, post Abbottabad, they had talked, there had been more chatter about Pakistan leasing Gwadar to the Chinese Navy as part of the String of Pearls. And do the Chinese have a doctrine about an attack on their assets outside of Chinese territory? Because it wouldn't take even a mildly devious Pakistani military to just put some of their nuclear assets in Gwadar intermingled with the Chinese, or, you know, we can do the same exercise for a conventional attack on their facilities in Burma.
Hmm. But
Paul, did you want to take
Paul Kerr, Congressional Research Service. This question is more for Dr. Tellis, but I agree with you that there's this asymmetry of perceptions between India and China, that India is obsessed with China's nuclear arsenal, China doesn't care about India's. But I was wondering, and I also agree that the perception is driving to a certain extent India's strategic choices, but what I have not heard and what I have never heard is a description of the missions for which India needs nuclear weapons or needs more nuclear weapons than it has now. I understand, I mean, even when I've asked Indian officials about this, I can't get an answer as to why they need nuclear weapons vis-a-vis China. If you could elaborate on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, I'll take the Gwadar port one first, I guess. I think in terms of when you look at Chinese doctrine or strategy, and I actually, this is something I didn't mention, but I thought was particularly interesting at the event, and I remember it got a huge response from Indian experts at the event, as one of the major generals who was in the room from the Chinese side retired. But he said, you know, we don't really use the term strategy in referring to how China conducts itself. And that just, you know, everyone thinks of Sun Tzu, and they have a really hard time divesting China from a strategic view of the world. And he pulled that apart, and he also pulled apart this idea of doctrine. He said Chinese don't use the word doctrine. They use things like guidelines, you know, strategic or nuclear guidelines. We're much more comfortable with those terms. I thought that's just something that was triggered in you saying this. So I think that, I don't necessarily buy into the idea that China has no strategy. But I don't buy into the idea, actually, that India doesn't think strategically either. You hear this quite a bit coming from the Indian side, and I think they're both sides are thinking strategically, just in different ways. Now, in terms of the String of Pearls idea, it's if you ask anyone in China, of course, they're going to say, oh, it doesn't exist. It's a figment of South Asian imagination. And and interestingly enough, the last time I was in India just recently, I was talking with an expert there, also high ranking in the military. And he said to me, you know, actually the Chinese have done us a favor. They're putting basically their assets, if they use these ports, close enough to us that we can strike them very easily. I mean, they're basically making themselves vulnerable to us. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. We should be thanking them. From the Chinese standpoint, I think that you'll see, and it's not just on the port issue. It's across the boards, globally speaking. The idea that you expand your economic web further and further and not have the military backup and wherewithal to be able to rescue, say, your employees in Libya who are confronted with a crisis situation, or in Latin America, or in the Indian Ocean. I still believe that this is part and parcel to that. I don't tend to, and I know I'm talking about my own view, but I think that the Chinese will often actually justify it in this way. They'll say that it's backing up their own economic pursuits in these regions. And I think it largely is. To say that there's no larger strategic purpose, though, I think would also be naive. So I think that, you know, if I had to do a percentage, I'd say it's probably 80% economic still at this point. They still tend to go the economic route and how they justify something. But down the line, 20 years from now, 10 years from now, it's hard to say what purpose those ports and other things will serve, their dual use.
It's hard to answer that question directly because you won't find Indian policymakers kind of articulating why they need nuclear weapons vis-a-vis China or anybody else. But I can offer you some deductions that appear plausible. One is the moment somebody else has nuclear weapons, it creates a set of demands on the other. I mean, if you end up in a quasi-competitive relationship with one state having nuclear weapons, then it raises questions about what do you have in your quiver to deter the other from using those instruments, should they choose to, for political purposes. And so the Indian argument has always been that India requires nuclear weapons first and foremost to prevent nuclear coercion. And nuclear coercion is a, you know, term of art, which is essentially a way of saying if one of the two parties in a dyadic relationship has nuclear weapons, it has inherent capacity to blackmail the other on a series of political issues. And so I think the first order Indian response would be, if China has nuclear weapons, then India needs nuclear weapons to deter blackmail. That's number one. Two, how many nuclear weapons does one need to deter blackmail? I don't think anyone has the answer to that, because you're now in the realm of metaphysics. The US had one set of answers during the Cold War, and it was a certain digit with a large number of zeros at the end. The Chinese and the Indians seem to have reached the conclusion that their objectives are satisfied by much smaller numbers. But it's not numbers per se. For India, it's less numbers, it's more reach. India has had a certain number of nuclear weapons. What that number is, I don't know. But for all practical purposes, those numbers, those nuclear weapons have simply not been deliverable to China. I mean, because it's not, India has not had the delivery systems to be able to deliver them with certainty. Most of the Indian investments right now are focused less on increasing numbers. In fact, it's quite remarkable how slow the Indians are in nuclear weapons production. Most of their activity is focused on building the missiles that will get the weapons they have to target. And where India is concerned, I mean, you're talking really now of asymmetries of geography. China is between half to two-thirds the size of India, and most of it is beyond the reach of traditional Indian instruments, which were essentially short-legged tactical aircraft. And so what the Indians are doing is slowly migrating from what was an air-breathing delivery system to a solid-fueled missile-based system with ranges of about 3,000 kilometers and above. And so I think their focus is less on building up the stockpile and more on building up the delivery capabilities that will enable them to get whatever stockpile they currently have to the targets that they think must be held at risk for successful deterrence.
In the back here. Both together is fine.
Do we go first? Oops, I fell down. I'm Randall Doyle, U.S. State Department. I'd like you to address the role that the United States can play, because both of you mentioned that they will play a role in there to some degree or another. I was talking to a scholar in Peking University a couple years ago, and he said to me that when the United States tries to enhance or help Indian technology, nuclear technology, it undercuts our efforts in trying to denuclearize North Korea and trying to contain the spread of nuclear technology coming from Pakistan. And it seems to me that this is really a web of enormous complexities. And then if you throw into the mix where the United States is confronting economic realities, and whether we like it or not, there is a very strong feeling in Asia that our ability to stay there for the long run is in question, which throws it back into the importance of whether India and China can actually find some kind of common ground to settle this situation between them to some kind of peaceful resolution. So could you address the potentiality of the United States, what role they can play, and also B, what happens if the United States does, in essence, just simply because of economic realities, does play a lower role in Asia, and what that will have, what kind of profound effect that will have on the relations between China and India?
Okay. Next one.
My name is Sam Letter. I'm with the Japanese Electric Power Companies, and that's a good segue to my question. About this civil nuclear cooperation and the potential for that between India and China. If they did move closer on this, you know, common ground that you were discussing, what would the U.S. impression of that be? Because, you know, the U.S. spent a lot of political capital on the India civil nuclear agreement and, you know, the potential for us to get in, our companies to get in on the development of the Indian nuclear industry is somewhat in doubt due to the liability laws over there. So if you know, I'm just curious, you know, how would we react if India and China moved closer on the civilian nuclear side? Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Do you want to take the first one? I'll take the second.
Sure.
Okay.
As you pointed out, I mean, it's a very complicated question about what role the U.S. can play, because it really depends on the issue area that you're talking about. There are some issue areas where the U.S. can play a role, and other areas where the U.S. simply can't play any role whatsoever. But to the larger question about our role in Asia, I think, and this may be just my prejudice, but my view is, if the U.S. cannot sustain the role that it has played in Asia for the last 60 years, which is essentially providing a security environment that guarantees, first, the security of key allies, and through that process creates enough positive externalities that other states can benefit from. If the U.S. cannot service this critical role, then you are talking of a very different Asia from the Asia we have known and loved. And I don't think we've quite understood what the implications of that alternative Asia are. And so my short answer, and it's not an answer that, you know, this is a complicated question, requires more extensive kind of reflection, but my short answer is that if that is the fork in the road, then what the U.S. ought to be doing first and foremost is not worrying about China and India, but worrying about itself. And that is worrying about strengthening its capacities in order to allow it to play that traditional role. Because we don't have a good theory about how you protect security and stability in Asia in the absence of the United States. We don't have a good theory to how to do that. And to my mind, if you don't have a good theory whose remote implications you can understand, then this is not an issue area where you want to learn by doing. I mean, the potential for a mess up is huge. And so from my vantage point, that brings me straight back to internal issues of domestic policy and less issues of foreign policy. It means being able to reinvigorate your economic capabilities, managing your financial problems, sustaining your capacity for innovation, and ultimately being able to maintain your military strength. If you can do these, then the opportunities you have to constructively intervene, in quotation marks, in Sino-Indian relations and any other increases. If you don't have that capability, then all the rest is academic.
I think, on the second question, I think in terms of civil nuclear cooperation, you know, when this first came out in 2006, my own read is that it was largely just for rhetorical purposes, to show a certain degree of commonality or the support for where India was headed and then also on the Chinese side as well. In terms of whether or not it can actually head anywhere, when I was talking about the positive reaction that was at this particular event having to do with civil nuclear issues, it was actually in largest part just because of the similarities of the programs already. Now, when you have these similar programs already in terms of fast breeder reactor programs and things like that, there are certainly areas of confluence where the two can learn from one another. In fact, if you read five-year plans and reports coming out of India, frequently I will see a chart or a graph taken from an India or a Chinese expected, anticipated production with over a certain length of time and so on. So I think that there's already some crossover there in terms of how India is planning, making its own plans, and they're looking to China. And I think that actually in post-Fukushima world, that's actually where they could have more cooperation and I think take things forward. In terms of where this takes us on an economic level, once again, Ashley just mentioned this whole idea that the United States needs to basically worry about itself in certain regards. I think that the issues that the United States is facing in its nuclear cooperation with India are much greater and more systemic and internal than necessarily anything that China would do to the system. In fact, Chinese cooperation with India would probably run into the same roadblocks that they've run into in the past. That doesn't mean that there shouldn't be efforts to at least engage on some of these issues that I was talking about. But I think that overall, the areas that they should be cooperating on the most is the fact that they do have very similar programs and similar plans for the future and very ambitious programs. And where it could lead to some positives would actually be in areas that, for example, if China's pursuing a certain route, like fast breeders or something, and they run into difficulties, that may actually have some spin-off benefits in preventing India from, say, undertaking a bad route, or vice versa. I think that's actually more what I was arguing. Thank you.
Thank you. Claudio Lilienfeld, McLarty Associates. I was wondering, in light of the asymmetries between India's and China's capabilities and the anxieties on the Indian side that both of you have talked about, creating sort of obsessive atmosphere or whatever, did it come up in the context of your sessions? And even if it didn't, I'd be interested in your commentary about the issue. You know, India's concerns, including strategic surprise, coercion, everything else, still exist then with this great asymmetry that exists and their capabilities that are developing. What, if anything, was raised on the question of missile defense and India's thinking on that front, and perhaps even how the Chinese might be perceiving that as well?
Mm-hmm. In terms of asymmetries, actually, it's interesting even just hearing Ashley talk, because I sense that there are these asymmetries, but in perceptual terms, I'm actually starting to realize that there are a lot of similarities. Even more so than I had listed earlier. When we just to go back briefly to what he was saying, because it feeds into what you've been talking about, in terms of nuclear coercion, concerns over blackmail. I mean, that's textbook Chinese concerns when it comes to its nuclear deterrent, not being about numbers. I think I had mentioned that also during the event. It's the same for both sides, and also this focus on delivery systems and on the conventional capabilities that are going to back up the strategic deterrent. That's already there. So when we talk about asymmetries in terms of, and surprise, when we're talking about these two powers, I think that the surprise, once again, actually stemmed more from the fact that, once again, that the Chinese had not really been exposed to these views in such a direct fashion in the past. When there was discussion of ballistic missile defense, I don't know that it necessarily actually took them in a direction of surprise, because even during the event, the Indian panelists were still emphasizing it's about Pakistan, it's not about China. What surprised them from the Chinese side is that they said, well, despite the fact it's about Pakistan, what's still in the shadows is China, once again, with its delivery and its assistance on missiles, the M9 and the M11. That came up, and you know, anyone who's been working on India for a while knows at some point M9 and M11 are going to come up in the conversation. And it wasn't a surprise for the people in the room who are working on Sino-Indian relations per se. They've been dealing with this a long time. But the people working on nuclear issues, they were the ones who were particularly surprised that even China, that there was such a close linkage between China and Pakistan, especially on the nuclear side of things. And so ballistic missile defense was seen more, the fact that it was couched in the sense that China had been providing all this assistance to Pakistan over time, and that this was a trigger mechanism. Whether or not it's about Pakistan now, China still is playing a role. And I think that's where the asymmetry lay, and there was a little bit of a surprise in the room.
If I could just ask, did you get a sense of Indian thinking about how it was looking at missile defense in its context with respect to China or Pakistan and or Pakistan?
Yeah, I think, certainly at least for those who wrote on the topic and are also speaking about the topic, once again, they were seeing it as basically the entire program is being targeted at Pakistan at this stage of the game. And it's mainly for a lot of reasons of just capabilities at this stage. You know, they're working on getting to the 2,000-kilometer range. I mean, there's even if you just look at the statements and the capabilities that are out there, it's still Pakistan-oriented, and the Chinese are aware of that as well. And I think that, you know, while in the future, yes, there could be implications for China. And I will say this, my acquaintances, my colleagues, some of my fellow students at Tsinghua University, where I was doing my PhD, these are Chinese students. Some of them came from ballistic, they were in the profession, actually, working on ballistic missiles and other things for China. And I was struck by the fact that they were so particularly interested in missile defense, in these developments on the missile side, not just the Agni 3, but also missile defense itself. So they're thinking down the line. I mean, while they say that strategy is not important in the Chinese language, I think that they are thinking strategically long term. And in particularly in the scientific community as well. You'll see even reports on, say, India's developments on missiles and also missile defense and also on space now appearing in technical journals, which heretofore you never saw.
All the way in the back, and then one over here as well.
Yeah, my name is John Schussler. I'm with Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. I was curious if you could talk a little bit about the asymmetry in testing between India and China. The Indians have very few tests, and that has important implications for warhead design, missile modernization, because you need a smaller warhead, and surety of the nuclear deterrent, and how that might be impacted by a return to testing in India, either in response to a Pakistani test or a change in political leadership.
Yes, Grant Smith from the Central Asia Caucasus Institute, and previously with the State Department in South Asia. No first use policies. Has China addressed what it would do if India should develop a counterforce or possibly preempt a counterforce strategy vis-a-vis Pakistan?
Take those two. Okay, on the testing front, interestingly enough, even though we had an entire session which had to do with regime and CTBT and various issues, interestingly, I didn't get the sense that there was a great deal of critical thinking, at least from the Chinese side. Actually, this applies to both of your questions, on what ifs in view of the Indian arsenal. I felt like a lot of them were operating on the assumptions of what is occurring now, you know, what is on the ground already. And that was how they were making their strategic planning. Yes, they're looking at down the line where they might be headed, but there wasn't much discussion of it. And that, I think, was unfortunately one of the points which I think actually deserves future discussion at our events. In terms of testing overall, I mean, I certainly know from my own time spent in India that there is discussion of whether or not that option should be left open. If India were to conduct another test, I've asked Chinese analysts, and now I'm going into my own research now, I've asked scientists and other analysts whether or not they felt that might trigger a reaction from China. How would they react to a test on the part of India? How would they react to India expanding its arsenal? First of all, a lot of them just felt, at least in terms of expanding the arsenal, that wouldn't happen. If a test were to occur, 9 times out of 10, they will say that, well, nothing will happen. Nothing will change. China will never change its policy. It's inured to that entire dynamic, and that they wouldn't necessarily be concerned about it. That being honest, that's probably what their response would be, and has been when I've asked them about this in the past. In terms of a counterforce strategy vis-a-vis Pakistan, once again, I don't know that this is something that the Chinese would particularly be concerned about. I think it's something that they would be, you know, it's interesting because I just had another event as a follow-up event with young scholars, and we were talking, it was an entirely Chinese group of young scholars and also a few more senior ones as well. And on this issue of the India-Pakistan equation, I found a great deal of delinkage going on, where they really weren't thinking about the implications of what's going on in the Indo-Pakistan relationship and how that might actually ricochet up and affect China. In fact, I tried to make an argument that, well, maybe there's a chain, you know, between these and those linkages, if there's a destabilization, if those two countries decide to expand their arsenals and then, you know, and test again, how will China react? And once again, there was not much of a reaction. They said, we won't have a reaction because we're most concerned about the United States.
You want to jump in on that?
Well, the testing question is, I take your point completely, and I understand the logic that underpins what you're saying. But it's a hard question to answer, partly because there is no universal consensus on what India achieved or did not achieve in its 98 tests. The Indians are absolutely convinced that they were successful. And if you take that proposition at face value, then they have what they need to sustain and build up an arsenal. Now, in the West, there has been considerable skepticism about whether the Indian tests in 98 were as successful as advertised. And if you take that proposition to be true, then obviously one would presume that if you wanted extremely high levels of confidence about the technical effectiveness of your deterrent, at some point or another, you would be compelled to test. I mean, that proposition flows inexorably from the judgment that these tests may not have been successful. We don't really know what the Indians believe about their own tests. I mean, people have lots of theories, but nobody can assert this authoritatively. My own view has been that the Indians are far more relaxed than we sometimes feel from the outside. And the reason they are relaxed is because they really think of nuclear deterrence in existential terms rather than in theoretical terms. The real Indian doctrine, I'm telling you a secret here, so the real Indian doctrine about its nuclear weapons is actually existential deterrence, not minimum deterrence. Minimum deterrence is the rhetoric. It's what is used in the public discourse, and people argue about what it means. But they believe that nuclear weapons are such horrendous instruments that the very fact that both sides may possess them almost virtually automatically ensures successful deterrence. Now, we may sit down and argue, you know, whether this is true or not. But the point is, if you believe this to be true, then the imperatives to go back and test are diminished substantially. Now, this doesn't mean that India will not test if the right opportunities were offered. I mean, their scientists are just like ours. You know, they want to create the latest gadget and make certain that it works, you know, as the specs require it to. But these are not decisions that will be made by scientists. They are going to be made by politicians. At least in the Indian system, it's the political leaders that call the shots. And if the politicians believe in some theory of existential deterrence, which is the impression I have, then, you know, it's not as if, you know, they're chafing and chomping at the bit, just dying to test the first chance they get. And so my sense is, you know, the theorists will argue about, you know, what is the probability that any given nuclear device will actually produce the yield that it is supposed to by design. Whether, you know, that probability is high under a whole set of circumstances. But these are things that, you know, our friends at Livermore and elsewhere would have also done during the Cold War.
If it's worth doing, it's worth doing 1,000 times over.
That's right, exactly. But I mean, I think Indian politicians think of nuclear weapons in the way that McGeorge Bundy once wrote about them. That even the use of a single nuclear weapon is so catastrophic and beyond the pale to behold that, you know, even the whiff, even the suspicion that you have these wretched devices somewhere in the basement, you know, ought to give someone pause, because if these things actually were to go off as advertised, they would simply be catastrophic all around. So the point I'm making is that there is a divide in terms of how technologists and scientists and operators think about these weapons, and the political decision makers, who have a very different calculus, and for that reason seem to be far more relaxed about the quality of their arsenal than many outsiders who watch that arsenal actually are.
And I just as a two-finger on that, I agree. I think I've noticed, at least in terms of the political side, this existential deterrence, I think, is fitting. But I would also add that, I mean, you know, for making the final decision, I never want to take it away from the politicians, but I definitely have seen a great deal of debate going on at the military and academic level about this, and to whatever, and scientific level. And so it depends on how much credence you put into, at any given time, one of these other groups having enough sway to actually increase their influence. This is actually what happened after the ASAT test that China conducted, you know, in 2007. There was a big debate, even in China, Is this the scientists? Is this the military having more control than, say the politicians do of this particular issue? Is this a rogue action on the part of the state? And I'm not trying to make a complete direct comparison between the two, but I think it is important to differentiate between these different groups, because I have seen a great deal of talk about whether or not there needs to be a new test, and a lot of people that I've encountered would say, yes, there needs to be this. And they're coming from military, academic, and also scientific community, particularly the scientists, because they love to test things when they can. And I think also, just from the military side, the amount to which people were talking about this event, the number of people that were talking about the potential for China to actually use a nuclear weapon, you know, to use a nuclear weapon in an altercation over, say, Arunachal Pradesh or Aksai Chin. The fact that they're even thinking in these terms, where the Chinese would say, we would never do that. They like to talk about it as an existential threat as well. And yet, the fact that they may perceive that to be a potentiality, I think also changes the calculation as well, what you expect your adversary to do. And I felt that there was a pretty much almost a wedded sense that China has conditional no first use, has this non-universal concept of minimum deterrence. And that's where it's going to shape, I think, India's decisions as well.
Well, I think we're probably got time for one more question here, and then we'll wrap up.
Hello, I'm Avi Pant from NNSA. I was interested in what you said about this idea of existential deterrence and how that might percolate down to the targeting requirements level, you know, and also if you combine that with what you'd mentioned earlier about these fears that that India might have these perceptions of China's, you know, encirclement of India and all of that, how does that translate down to sort of how they conceptualize targets? And did either of you get a sense of this in talking to the Chinese or the Indians?
Well, whatever their conceptualization is, they won't be telling me anytime soon. What you can say quite safely, though, is that nuclear weapons are most effective when you use them against populations. I mean, they have a variety of utilities, there's no question. But the nature of the beast is such that their greatest utility is essentially for counter-population targeting. For defensive counter-population targeting. I mean, the offensive use of nuclear weapons is a somewhat spurious enterprise. Most Indians believe that if you have nuclear weapons that are survivable, and there is a threat that you can use them on the population centers of the adversary, the prospect of suffering the catastrophic damage that arises from such use is sufficient to deter. Right? That's the basic theory. Now, if one extrapolates from that, one can presume that if you have small numbers of nuclear weapons, then your greatest utility that you derive from small numbers is essentially for countervalue targeting. The moment you start using nuclear weapons, either on counter-military targets or on counter-force targets, the size of the arsenal begins to ramp up quite rapidly. And counter-military targeting is the worst, actually. I mean, that's the reason why we ended up with 30, 40,000 nuclear weapons, because we figured that there were wonderful bridges in Poland that could do with a few American nuclear weapons delivered by aircraft. By the time you multiply all the bridges in Poland, East Germany, Romania, Bulgaria, et cetera, your numbers go through the roof. The Indians don't want to go there. They don't want to make nuclear weapons this abstract, recondite stuff that we perfected at the RAND Corporation. They don't want to think of nuclear weapons as instruments of war fighting. From their point of view, nuclear weapons have one utility. They are instruments of deterrence. They are aimed first and foremost at the psychological calculus of the leadership of the adversary. And they are aimed to compel the adversary's leadership with the prospect of suffering unacceptable losses. And they judge that nuclear weapons will have their greatest utility if those unacceptable losses were to derive from targeting population centers, which also, thankfully for all of us, happen to be the economic centers in a modern economy. And so if you're thinking in terms of bang for the buck, and you have small numbers of weapons, I'm presuming, now this is all in the realm of deduction, right? I mean, these are the angels dancing on the pinhead kind of logic. I'm deducing that if you have small numbers of weapons, they'll aim them essentially for counter-value targeting. No Indian I've met, whether it is a politician all the way down to members of the military, has ever argued for using nuclear weapons in either counter-military mode or a counter-force mode. They can't do the latter for various technical reasons that I'll be happy to sit down with you and explore. And they certainly don't want to do the former because it produces tremendous demands on fissile material production, and they just don't want to go there. As Kenneth Waltz once said in one of his better lines was, you know, why do you need more if less is sufficient? That's essentially the mechanics which drive the calculations.
And just briefly, just to go on to the Chinese side of this, there's actually, once again, a good deal of crossover there. I mean, if you go back to Mao Zedong's time, which people love to do when they're going to talk about this whole idea of a paper tiger, you only need one nuclear weapon, really, to exert the form of deterrence that they see as necessary. Now, obviously, China has expanded well beyond one. But there's still, I have yet also to meet anyone that I think would be interested in moving away from this idea of a counter-value targeting. In moving towards counter-force, once again, as you already mentioned, you would have to expand your arsenal. And the issue in doing so is, once again, you have to bear in mind that they're looking at the United States as the ultimate target. They're defining everything within their nuclear system according to the United States. And I don't think that anyone has the confidence from the Chinese side that they would actually ever be able to target all of the targets that would be required to actually go toe-to-toe with the United States. That would not be part of their equation. Whether or not on the Indian side they would even go to that level, go to the trouble, I don't think is necessarily at this stage of the game within their calculations. So it wouldn't. I don't think they would apply it in the Indian case either. One of the things that's, this all being said, one of the things that's coming out quite, I would say, is becoming more and more current is this idea of interdependence, economic centers, and they're seeing the economic toll of, say, a counterattack or a strike is serving as the ultimate deterrent, because as everyone is much more interconnected now, you wouldn't want to take that chance. And so there's a tendency now when they're talking particularly about the USNPR, Nuclear Posture Review, to point to this idea of interdependence and strategic stability. You see the two really becoming interlinked, I think, in the Chinese conception. So they're thinking of it entirely in entirely different terms from the Cold War. They learned their lesson from that, most definitely. And I think that carries over into everything else they do. This being said, the last point I'll make is that I do know of, once again, fellow colleagues and students within Tsinghua, actually, who are doing work now on strategic stability and in trying to determine what that number is. You know, what is the McNamara number of today, particularly for China in terms of strategic stability? So they're still thinking, while they say they're not thinking numerically, there's still some studies going on. But I think those numbers would be well below anything that you would be able to determine as being a counterforce targeting.
Maybe they need to go back to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I believe the number was 42.
42.
Well, it's been a very enriching discussion, as Laura mentioned. So we'll be doing more work in this area. Eventually, the materials from this conference will be posted on our website. Please check back with us. Thank you all for coming out, and please join me in thanking my colleagues.
Thank you.